Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Bank of America tries to get better. The oil industry tries to deal with the Middle East, and the gang at Freakonomics tries to prove they're not rude. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellowbook 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. And by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 8th of March today. This one's a Tuesday. Glad, as always, to have you with us. Beleaguered Bank of America did something today it hasn't done in four long years. It hosted an investor conference, a chance for shareholders to chat up management and figure out what the heck is going on with a company that lost $3.5 billion last year. B of A is in the middle of a makeover after a long bout of indigestion, thanks to its purchases of Countrywide and Merrill Lynch, not to mention the whole financial crisis thing. The country's biggest bank has lots of work to do to get back to normal, but early reviews from investors are mostly positive, as our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
Bank of America said today the biggest thing its customers want is to restore their damaged sense of financial well-being. You could say that the bank wants the same thing for itself. Jeff Hart, an analyst with Sandler O'Neill, said Bank of America pleasantly surprised investors by not revealing any new financial disasters.
The biggest positive has probably been that there hasn't been a big negative. Let's face it, they're in the eye of every storm. I think expectations are very low.
Bank of America's big struggle has been to contain the lawsuits and losses from bad home mortgages that it inherited from Countrywide. CEO Brian Moynihan said part of the bank's strategy is to cut costs elsewhere.
Many of you ask me about expenses, and they are not satisfactory right now. There's no question. We're still eating large costs to deal with the mortgage issues.
That's going to take time and people to resolve. But Moynihan predicted the bank will turn in earnings of $40 billion before taxes this year. Bank of America will cut staff and close up to 10% of its branches. The bank has already sold off investments to focus on its main businesses. In the process, it raised $22 billion. But it won't be using that money for a buying spree. Moynihan jokingly declared that the bank will get a peace dividend by not buying more companies like Countrywide or Merrill Lynch. Here's Hart.
They're in a position where they've got the businesses they need or want. It's a matter of becoming more efficient.
Bank of America expects its cleanup to last several years. The question now is whether it will lose ground as it makes cuts, while big rivals like J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo are talking about their plans to add bankers and branches. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Here's your semi-regular update on the ever-expanding Facebook economy. There was news this morning that Warner Brothers is going to be the first studio to stream its films over the king of social networks. Warner's offering a 48-hour rental of The Dark Knight through Facebook. It's the latest in the Batman franchise. The price is 30 Facebook credits, $3 to you and me. And Marketplace's Steve Henn reports it's just another dip into the pot of gold for Facebook, but a potential nightmare for Netflix.
If I ran Netflix, I would be slightly sick to my stomach right now. 600 million Facebook users can stream The Dark Knight online right now. But if they want to watch that movie on Netflix, they have to wait for a DVD to show up in the mail.
I had a vision of a world without Batman.
Netflix has a vision of a world without DVDs, where all movies are streamed online, ideally using a Netflix subscription. The company already has thousands of titles you can watch this way. But the big studios won't let Netflix stream the really good stuff. They're still nervous that one company could dominate the online business. So that's why Warner Brothers approached Facebook to stream The Dark Knight. The deal couldn't be simpler. Facebook takes 30% of each download.
I think for studios, definitely the model is appealing.
Atul Bagga is an analyst at Think Equity. He says Facebook doesn't have anything that resembles an online movie store yet. But
we have already seen Facebook has caused a big disruption in the gaming world.
Social games on Facebook, like Farmville, have taken off, while game consoles, like Sony's PlayStation, are struggling. Justin Smith runs the site Inside Facebook.
Whenever Facebook starts experimenting with a new product in a new market, I think all the companies, particularly the leaders like Netflix, should pay close attention.
Warner Brothers is describing the Dark Knight rental deal as a test, but executives there say if this works, they'll also try selling movies on Facebook. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Bank of America shares gained almost 5% today. Netflix lost even more. Facebook shares, oh wait, it's not public yet, is it? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you want to talk oil, Houston, Texas is generally a pretty good place to be, and that is definitely true this week. There's a huge energy conference happening there right now. More oil company CEOs and analysts than you can shake a stick at. OPEC's got people there. It's so high profile, it's been called the Davos of the oil industry. Marketplace's Scott Tong didn't win a trip to the Swiss Alps this year, but he is on the line from Houston for us. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
So what's the mood? Oil's at 105. Libya's still in trouble. How are people feeling?
I'm looking for panic, but they don't have any here, Kai. I spoke to a Kuwaiti oil executive who said, you know, this is what we do every day, is we manage risk and deal with these parts of the world that are unstable, but that happens to be where the hydrocarbons often are. And so this is not anxiety, she told me. This is life. So short term, here's what the numbers show, that even if Libya's production is taken offline, 1 million barrels per day, et cetera, Saudi Arabia has plenty of spare capacity to compensate for that. They say this over and over at this conference. They also say, you know, in the Middle East, there have been a lot of wars in Algeria and in Yemen, and production kept up. The head of the French oil company Total said this morning that countries should not go to their emergency stockpiles because that would be a sign of panic to the market. And we don't want to tell the world that we're panicking because there's no reason for it.
Well, okay, that works, it seems to me, in the short term, Scott. But what about longer term if this Libya thing drags on and if unrest in the Middle East stays shaky?
The longer term picture is a totally different story. You talked about what's happening on the oil supply side. What a lot of people talk about here is on the demand side. Going forward, if you have 7-8% growth in emerging markets, you have an Indian middle class, a China middle class, growth in Brazil, more people with cars and cell phones, supply is not going to be able to keep up with that. A few minutes ago, the head of BP said the world before long will consume 40% more energy than we do today. So that's the warning sign. And it could be, according to the CEO of Hess Oil Company, that we're going to have to ration oil in 3 or 4 years. And, you know, we could have another price spike, which means $140 a barrel, which we had in 2008. Might not be an aberration, but a warning of a future that's coming. Not tomorrow, but, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years.
One of the things that happens, two things happen when oil gets this high. One is that people start talking about more domestic production, drilling here, which is an entirely different conversation. But alternatives and renewables become more attractive. They become more cost-effective. Is there any talk of that among oil industry executives at this conference?
A lot of these oil companies invest in those renewables. They invest in wind and solar. A lot of them obviously are in natural gas, which has a much smaller carbon footprint and is a domestic source of energy. What a lot of the projections say is, you know, all these things are not going to get there in time. You know, electric vehicles, a next generation battery, maybe 10, 15 years away. Wind and solar are on a very long runway, so they're not going to be deployed in gigantic numbers anytime soon. So what we really need is more of everything. There's a lot of talk of everything. We need more natural gas, more renewables, more efficient cars and homes. And yes, we do need more oil. Now, it's certainly self-serving for people at a conference like this to say that. But the alternative, according to the head of the French oil company Total, is, you know, the world goes dark.
Marketplace's Scott Tong in Houston for us, talking about the future, short-term and long-term, for the oil industry and us. Scott, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
There's legal news from Egypt today. Court in Cairo has rejected an appeal from former President Hosni Mubarak. He wants to stop prosecutors from seizing assets that have been linked to him and his family. And there is some speculation now that this could eventually mean a criminal trial for Mubarak. Already, some prominent Egyptian businessmen and former government officials have been arrested on corruption charges, something that would have been unheard of just a couple of months ago. Commentator Michelle Dunn says those are just some of the changes that Egyptians are going to have to get used to.
Is Egypt ready for democracy? You've probably heard these facts over the last few weeks. Some 20% of the Egyptian population lives on $2 a day. More than 30% of the public suffers from illiteracy. Reforms that were made by the former president, Hosni Mubarak, tended to be distributed unequally among Egyptians. The rich were getting richer, and the poor were getting poorer. There's no middle class to speak of. That must make you think the answer is no. But we need to look deeper at trends in Egypt and what they predict for the future of democracy. Compare Egypt to other countries. Egypt is a lower middle-income country by international standards, by no means among the poorest of the poor. Income per capita and the equality of income distribution are similar to, or better, than those in India and Indonesia, two countries that made successful transitions to democracy. Middle-class and poor Egyptians have definitely felt the pinch of rising global commodity prices and have not had their fair share of economic growth. That's due to corruption, but also because public education has failed to prepare their children for the private sector jobs that previous reforms generated. But the idea that the middle class has disappeared is a myth. In fact, the Egyptian middle class has grown as a percentage of the overall population for decades, from about 20% in the 1950s to roughly 50% by the 1990s. The percentage under the poverty line fell steadily until at least 2008, when it rose slightly as the global economic downturn hit. So, is Egypt ready for democracy? Egyptians are now embarked on what will probably be a long political journey with many detours. But they have a large civil society and well-developed state institutions, and the socioeconomic indicators are not as bad as many outsiders imagine.
Michelle Dunn is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's also the editor of the online journal The Arab Reform Bulletin. Write to us when you get a minute, marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. Coming up, Freakonomics. They're rude, but at least they're not mean.
We certainly don't do the big no-no, which is the Twitter one-night stand, where you sign up to follow a ton of people just to get them to follow you back, and then you dump them a day later.
Nice, Dubner, nice. But first, let's do the numbers. Oil taketh, and oil giveth back. Today, easing oil prices gave Wall Street a welcome breather. The Dow Industrials leapt? I don't know. 124 points, 1% closed at 12,214. The NASDAQ added 20 points, 0.75%, finished at 2765. The S&P 500 tacked on 11 points, about 0.9% there, ended things at 1321. Financial stocks led the rebound. Bank of America, we told you about earlier. Expectations of higher dividends fueled gains by other bank shares. J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup each rose about 2.5% or better. Yesterday, high oil prices had airlines rolling back growth plans. Today's ebb sent airline stocks skyward, none more so than U.S. Airways. It soared 11.8% on this Tuesday. For you hipsters out there, Urban Outfitters reported disappointing earnings due to higher costs. Its shares unraveled by nearly 17% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.55%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRowePrice.com. By Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. And by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality.
Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for the month of January. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee holds a hearing on the state of the housing market. And the National Association of Counties wraps up its annual legislative conference in Washington. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. China's annual legislative session, it's called the National People's Congress, has started. This week, the premier, Wen Jiabao, said that China is going to basically eradicate poverty, his words, by the year 2020. No poverty in China, 9 years from now. Seems like a pretty tall order, but it does make you think about this. Just how do you get poor people out of poverty? Well, you could pay them. One of the most effective anti-poverty programs out there does just that. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler went to Mexico for the story.
Kids play in between hundreds of mothers waiting in line at this school gymnasium in Monterrey, Mexico. Moms have gathered here for payday. The government program Oportunidades, Spanish for opportunities, covers 34 million people. That's one in three Mexicans. It doles out what are known as conditional cash transfers. Essentially, these are small financial rewards for meeting certain obligations, like taking kids to get regular medical checkups or keeping them in school. The education stipend starts at $29 a month for elementary school, up to $185 a month to keep a high school senior from dropping out. That money makes a huge difference for people like 58-year-old Maria Guadalupe Reyna.
Economically, it's very hard to take care of seven kids. Just getting them enough food to eat is very difficult.
Like many mothers here, she plans to spend her stipend on groceries. Oportunidades has helped cut malnutrition around Monterrey by half. Independent studies also show that the program helps break the cycle of poverty that extends from one generation to the next. Reyna has no formal career, but her son is now a professional.
Because of the program, my oldest son is now an accountant.
Part of the secret of the program's success is giving the power of the purse to women. Maribel Acosta helps run Oportunidades in the state of Nuevo León.
The aid money is given to the account holder, who is usually the mother of the family. The mom has the best understanding of how to handle the family's finances.
In other words, moms are better with a budget. The program also gets mothers to rethink the value of education. In the past, kids got pulled out of school to help support the family, especially girls.
We give more support for girls as an incentive to keep them studying instead of taking the girl out of school so she can go to work.
Mexico spends about $5 billion a year on Oportunidades. Critics say the program bribes people to do what they should be doing anyway. Helen Uribe disagrees. She's with the World Bank, which loans Mexico money for the program.
It's considered a very good investment because it's ensuring that the poorest people are better off and that the children invest in education, the mothers invest in nutrition and health, which is well known is one of the best investments that both families and countries can make.
In the long run, investing in preventive health care can save Mexico money on emergency services. And Ribe says giving kids grants to go to school can pay off, too.
Kids that completed the program and graduated tend to have about 10% more income.
A similar program in Brazil has dramatically reduced poverty and inequality there. Altogether, 30 countries are experimenting with conditional cash transfers. But the model doesn't work everywhere. A pilot program in New York City got mixed reviews. And even in Mexico, the program has not been as successful in big cities. Urban health services may be lousy or not available, and kids in the program often graduate from college only to find no available jobs. But whatever its shortcomings, the program gets enthusiastic support from the mothers at the gymnasium. Blanca Najero even credits Oportunidades with saving her marriage.
I thank God for this program. Before, I was going to split from my husband because of economic problems.
Someday, when she grows older, Oportunidades could help Najero again. The safety net has been expanded to include benefits for the elderly. In Monterrey, Mexico, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
It's time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we spend some time with Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. Dubner, I'll tell you, it is spectacular to have you back.
Hi there. I am happy to be back on at MKT Place Radio. Last time left me R-O-F-L. Wanted to get back ASAP. 2 weeks away is too long. Hashtag.
All right, so,
I miss Kai.
Obviously, we're talking today about Twitter.
Yeah, that was 140 characters worth of hello, Kai. Exactly.
Was
140
it really?
Characters. Yep, you got it. Including the exclamation points.
Now, since we are talking about Twitter, first of all, I'm at Kai Rizdahl, and you guys are at Freakonomics. But here's the thing. You guys are jerks in, like, Twitter land, right? I mean, you have, like 250,000 people following you, and yet you follow no one.
We follow zero people, yeah.
Now,
so some people, like you, might call us jerks.
Or, yes.
Since we're talking Twitter here, they might call us twerks.
Yeah, I never liked the whole TW in front of words. But anyway, that's just, like, cold. It's, like, rude, right? Marketplace follows 350-something people.
Yeah, I see you follow the Financial Times and Politico, NASCAR, I like that. David Lynch. Well, and I see you also follow Freakonomics, so thank you for that.
Yeah, we do, because we are reciprocal kind of people here, obviously not like you. And I actually enjoy myself a little NASCAR, but why you won't even follow us. I hate that.
Well, here's the thing. When we set up our account, we were advised by very brilliant media strategists that it was bad form to expect anyone to follow us if we weren't following a whole lot of people back. But we kind of didn't want to turn it into some tit-for-tat thing, where pretty soon you're spending your whole day on Twitter worrying about whom to follow and who to be followed by, so...
But isn't reciprocity the name of the game here? Shouldn't you follow people, right? That's the basic point. And I've gotten myself a little expert here. I'm going to introduce you to a guy named Joe Fernandez. He's the CEO of a company named Clout. And every day, Clout analyzes data from all those bajillion tweets that are out there. They look at what gets retweeted, who's paid attention to, and then they give them a grade, or what's called a Clout score. So, Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So talk to me about this analysis of Twitter strategy that you guys do, and specifically what Dubner's doing in not following people. Is Dubner being rude here? Don't you have to follow to get followers?
For most people, that is the case, that it's really, really tough, unless you're Kanye West or something, to get people to care enough about what you say without any intention of possibly even listening back.
So here's the thing, Joe and Kai, you know, for us, the way we use Twitter is just as a kind of bullhorn to let people know what we're up to. Now, Joe, I do see that the biggest tweeters in the world, so Lady Gaga and President Obama, for instance, they each follow hundreds of thousands of people. But I mean, come on, really, do those people really think that Lady Gaga and President Obama are reading their tweets?
I'm guessing a lot of them probably do think that from some of the behavior we see on Twitter. The method of using Twitter as just a broadcast medium and your publishing content from Freakonomics, that is also powerful. And it's different than a person who's using Twitter to engage with their network and their friends. For celebrities like a Lady Gaga, I think they use the follow as, you know, a small act of kindness to their fans.
That's so funny. That's Stephen Dubner right there, the benevolent Twitterer, right? He just lets people follow him and sort of takes all the love. Hey, Joe, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, so Dubner, defend yourself here, will you?
So look, I get your point. We may not be the best Twitter citizens in the world, but you know, at least we're up front. We don't pretend to care about people that we don't care about. And we certainly don't do the big no-no, which is the Twitter one-night stand where you sign up to follow a ton of people just to get them to follow you back, and then you dump them a day later.
Yes, right. Very, very cold. But I'm going to stick to my guns here, and you know what? I bet the Twitter sphere will back me up.
Let me bring in my expert, my little Marshall McLuhan moment here. This is right. Duncan Watts, who's a sociologist who works as a research scientist at Yahoo. Duncan recently wrote a paper called Who Says What to Whom on Twitter. And Watts says it's very important that we don't confuse Twitter with social media like Facebook, where reciprocity, as you put it, Kai, really is the coin of the realm.
Yeah. It's worth emphasizing again here that Twitter is not a social network. Now, social networks are characterized by very, very high levels of reciprocity. So if I say that I'm friends with you, it's very likely that you will also say that you're friends with me.
And I am proud, Stephen Dubner, to call you a friend, but I still think you're not a reciprocal kind of guy. So are you going to change your Twitter ways or not?
You know, I think we're going to stick with our plan for now, but with one small change. Kai, do you happen to have a computer anywhere
I do.
Near
we've
you there?
We've got sophisticated studios here at Marketplace.
Do me a favor. Open up your the Freakonomics Twitter page if you
all
don't
right.
mind.
There it is. It's up. You're following one. Hey,
you
are you following
interesting
us?
There?
Look at that.
I got to tell
That's
you,
awesome.
I do know where to find the unfollow button on Twitter too. So
and so do I. I can unfollow you as fast as you can unfollow me. Unbelievable. Stephen J. Dubner. You can get him on Twitter at Freakonomics. He is our Freakonomics correspondent. You can subscribe to their podcast as well and a whole lot more. FreakonomicsRadio.com. Dubner, we'll see you.
Lots of hashtags to you, Kai.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at Putnam.com/large cap equity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we learn once again that the rich really are different. A consulting firm called the Spectrum Group did a survey of millionaires, asked them how their financial advisors can keep them happy and thus keep their business, one presumes. The secret? Return phone calls really fast. 40% of people surveyed, 40% of millionaires surveyed, expect to call back within 2 hours. In fact, not getting their calls returned quickly was more likely to make people find new financial advisors than getting lousy financial advice was. Think about that for a second. Me, by the way, I'm just happy when people call. It's pathetic. I know, but it's true. And on that note is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped to 124 points, 1%. The NASDAQ added 20 points, about 0.75%. The S&P 500 put on 11 points, 9 tenths of 1%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you ought to tune tomorrow for the latest, in fact, the earliest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back here, why one country takes the top spot in clinical trials.
The number one reason why companies come to Russia is that they can enroll patients anywhere from 3 to 20 times faster.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.